Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Jane DeLynn, the author, most recently, of Bad Sex is Good. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Jane's earlier novels are Some Do, In Thrall, Real Estate, and Don Juan in the Village, and this collection takes the opportunity to gather some of the chapters of those earlier, now out of print, novels, along with some short stories and some essays, some of which have appeared in anthologies and some collected for the very first time. Now, one of the things that you've always told me, Jane, and that I've never really commented on before, is that you are, in fact, a social realist. And as a result, this collection...
I was embarrassed to tell you that because I'm not sure about your opinion of social realists.
But as a result, this collection goes from Some Do with its account of student riots, the flashback in Thrall with its account of an affair with a high school English teacher, Real Estate, the avaricious 70s, Don Juan in the Village, the lascivious 80s, and it seems to me that this is a history of sexual malfeasance.
Yes, that's one way of looking at it. An increasing disillusionment, I suppose, accompanies this.
Now tell me, because it is very rare for a social historian, in a sense, to be so far inside the thought process of a first-person narrator. This is your history of sexuality from the first person. Did you know when you started out that this would be the impulse in your writing?
No, but and not all the books were in the first person, although I think the last several have. But I guess for me the impulse in writing was somehow to reveal what was hidden and most embarrassing, partly because when I was young and was gay before it was okay to be gay, any little strand, the kiss in Mrs. Dalloway, for instance, was very reassuring to me. And there's two ways to deal with your oddness and your fears and your shames, and one is to completely conceal them. And then the other is to express them, and with the hope, perhaps, that once they're fully expressed, the shame is going to go away. I'm not sure that's happened. So it's in a way, it's a very psychological impulse that has led me to do this. And but it also, for me, in a way, sex is. We don't go to war on the whole, or most people don't go to war anymore. And in a way, I guess it's been my proving ground. Everybody, you know, has their battles, having been. Some people, it's their intelligence or whatever. But, you know, that was always rewarded for me. So interpersonally, being with another person, it's where my self-consciousness and actually my most interesting thoughts have always, say, occurred in bars when I was waiting maybe to go over to try to meet somebody. And so I wanted to record those and tell the truth of those moments as much as I could.
Now, you say in this book that you don't like to make things up. And although I know you're partially joking, you say that you don't even like to make up the color of a partner's eyes, there is the impulse to be rigorous in your truth-telling, which has made you the enemy of many.
Well, we can judge a person's worth by their enemies, I guess, as well as by their friends, or perhaps better. Yeah, I mean, to some extent, you know, I do feel writers are lazy in a way. But, you know, if I can use the superficial things that are true, I think it'll help me recreate the truths. And sometimes when I've written about something that's happened to me, I no longer remember, you know, the reality from what I created, even though I know that there's certain different things. Which is not to say that everything I write about has occurred or is autobiographical, but it occurs in my brain. And for me to write well, not for other people, and I'm jealous of other people, but for me to write well, it's like it could have occurred in some sense. So even when I write things that are totally fantastical, they're occurring somewhere inside my head, second by second. Otherwise, I feel I'm faking it.
Now, tell me, comes as an enormous shock if, as you're reading Bad Sex is Good by my guest, Jane DeLynn, published by Painted Leaf Press, one begins to know a first-person narrator. Even if the novels are not themselves first-person, the sections excerpted here, by and large, are, or are in part. Even some do, has an eye speaking in a political rally. And so one comes to know a certain person that one assumes is Jane DeLynn, something like Jane DeLynn.
Mm.
She tells us that she tells the truth. She tells us she does not like to make things up. And then suddenly, in a chapter from a novel yet to come out, she's being trained as a dog, walked, fondled, taken through the most humiliating circumstances. And it seems that from the early novels, which were full of the possibility of an eye for an eye taking power, the books have been a success of surrendering of power and descent into degradation. Why is this?
I assume you're not asking a psychological question.
Never.
Why is this? I guess I feel when I write about sex, it's not just sex. It's being a person. And my joke about the dog stuff, which this later book ends up in an even stranger place, is that what's humiliating is not as being a dog who in some ways get treated very well by their masters. Dogs are rarely divorced. They are put to sleep, but kindly. They get fed. But what's humiliating and stressful, certainly stressful, is being a human being. And the dog is, I guess, for me, the ultimate metaphor of it's even further than being a sexual slave, because you're totally commanded. And later on, the person loses the ability to even talk, for instance, or write. But in that, there's a kind of freedom, because what I find oppressive about I find modern society is just absolutely terrifying, stressful, anxiety-ridden, and in a way it's a utopian version of a life, is to be totally taken care of. A human being will not do that for another human being almost anymore, maybe a child. But for an adult, you know, who's going to take care of us? And so that's kind of what it's about.
Well, it is, in fact. I noticed that the books proceed to a vision of bliss that involves the freedom not to make choices.
I guess this is, you know, when you have a to-do list as long as mine, you know, that's a positive thing. It's also about trying to feel, and that for me is the other. I think it's linked up with that anxiety prevents us from being present in our experience. And in a way, the characters in these stories are always worried about, are they feeling, or are they feeling properly, or are they feeling enough? And it's a performance anxiety that's inverted on, not for giving the other person pleasure, but rather on themselves, whether they're evincing, you know, whether they're feeling it inside, and also whether they're showing that they're evincing it inside in a way that's convincing to the other person. So it's all about the performance anxiety, which isn't just about sex, but it's just about everything in our society. Do I go to a dinner party? Am I wearing the right thing? You know, do I try to look more casual than the other people so I look like I'm superior to the situation? Or do I dress up to show that I have some very elegant Italian outfit? You know, every second of my life, anyway, is permeated by this. And
well, it's interesting because from the very beginning, at least chronologically, narrative chronologically, the beginning, the girl in Thrall, what's her name?
Lynn.
Similarity
to my last to Lynn. And after that, but people used to call me Lynn sometimes, and it was like.
Well, she has fear about not being able to breathe or being able to swallow. And these things come to her at night, you know. And it has always been the DeLynn narrator not being able to sleep, not being able to breathe, not being able to swallow, not being able to eat. Now, one would expect a novel of the rarest kind of hypersensitivity, and yet these seem to be not neurasthenic books, but highly comic books, as if these difficulties were somehow funny.
Well, I try to turn them into humor because you either laugh or you just cry forever at the human condition. I mean, it's amazing that we swallow, that we learn to hold in our bowels and stuff. And I've always, you know, the extremes of anxiety, and I think some people with mental problems have trouble controlling those things. But it's amazing that we're all able to, every other second, no matter what tragedies we're going through, we manage to swallow our food properly, to keep on breathing, to not go to the bathroom in inappropriate places. And of course, when you're dying and you're, you know, that's what those things go, and you sort of retreat to your infantile state. But that's part of the effort of being a human being. But I guess I try to laugh. And when I read, you know, people do laugh in recognition, which makes me feel that I'm not like a crazy person, but I'm relating on some level to other people's anxieties as well.
Well, part of the effect comes from the fact that here, while the narrator may be telling you about breathing problems or others, the sentences, nevertheless, come so smoothly and inexorably. They are, despite the fact that they narrate fairly crippling self-consciousnesses, the self-consciousness is not so crippling as to stop itself. And so they become sort of Cartesian comedy routines about the unstoppability of thought.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, you know, Beckett was always writing about the meaninglessness, but the writing was the meaning. I mean, there's something about that's my form of endurance, maybe, as you keep on writing, you're hopefully creating meaning out of this, and then you can keep going on. I think if I couldn't write about it, you know, who knows?
Now, in Bad Sex is Good, what I notice is, as I was saying, there's a sort of decade-by-decade rendering of sexual mores and malfeasances. You've always seemed to want to be at the extreme edge of whatever decade you're narrating, yes?
Yeah.
And it also seems to me here that if one were to pretend that these did not come from different books, you would have a War and Peace-like effect of time going by. Have you ever thought of constructing a historical novel that is not, in fact, in the moment, but chapter by chapter, a procession of decades?
No, but I think that's how I would have to do it, since I'm so terrible at ordinary forms of transition. I have thought of the section that the dog book is from. I consider that book, which is, I don't use the name because it doesn't have a final title, but I consider that part three of the Don Juan trilogy. So you could say it's covering 80s, say, through upper 90s. I have a fear of really gigantic books. I think they tend to fail. But little books can fail, too. So maybe fail, you know, in a majestic, large way.
When you speak of the Don Juan trilogy, what is that?
Well, the first part is Don Juan in the Village, and part two is unwritten. But I think of it more as tales of sort of less about cruising, more maybe focusing on humiliation. And then part three is the final voyage, where it sort of ends up, which we're calling at the moment abdication. It's sort of the end of the line sexually, and it seems, if you're talking about decade by decade, that 90s seem to kind of not be a sexual era in that sense. So it's kind of probably, you know, it'll be the last I'll be writing about, you know, this subject matter for a while.
Now, I wonder, because the subject of the books and the writing of the books is so hand in hand for you, I've wondered whether that interest ongoing, willed or not, in degradation, might have something to do as well with the position of the writer in society. I know that almost every writer who's been working in America for a long time, who's been on the show, has spoken really of virtually the disappearance of this profession. Norman Mailer said to me that it now amounts to something antique, like being the person who drives the horse carriages around Central Park, that being a novelist is an outdated profession. Is that part of the ongoing humiliation here?
It's part of it. I mean, I find all aspects of life contribute to one sort of not being affirmed in any sense, you know, by the universe. Growing older, you know, is another way, especially today. But in all eras, you become in a way more invisible. If you haven't reached a certain success level by a certain point, you sort of are treated as irrelevant. I think you're substantially right, and I'm trying to deal with the extremes of it, I think, in a way, you know, as a way to kind of handle it and see what value there is in it. There does seem to be, like people with Genet, you know, there's something about reaching the utter degradation. First of all, there's nowhere left to fall, and all the worst is known, so there's no secrets to conceal anymore, and that is a space of peace. And you don't have to strive, you know, strive and fail. So I do connect utter degradation with utter peace. It's sometimes in your life when you feel you've lost everything, there's this freedom because you can make new choices. And so it's about trying to get to that place where there is peace. And maybe that's the only way I can envision getting there. It's certainly with my psychology, and I think it is that my need to be known in a certain way, and that's why playing with the truth, whether, yes, I'll say that I always tell the truth. Of course, that's a lie in the book. But in some way, it seems I'm always telling the truth, even when the truth didn't happen.
I'm speaking to Jane DeLynn, the author of Bad Sex is Good. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. From the very first time I met you, you've made certain demands. You'll say, I'm a writer, so you must tell me about this. Otherwise, how can I know it? And I must know everything. So I'm curious about what the writer's role now is at a time that seems to be rejecting or at any rate abandoning its writers.
I always feel uncomfortable about talking about the writers' roles because I feel like I'm sounding those people that my mind immediately glazes over when, you know, the role of the writer in modern society.
No, I ask you because you always, in fact, find the most perverse opposition to a formal, pleasant role. You know, your job has always been...
I like to be difficult and disliked. If you're going to be disliked, you might as well pretend that you've created it on purpose. Well, I do think that for me, the writer's role is not to write, is either to create absolutely aesthetically beautiful empty objects, say like Rob Grier did in The Labyrinth, which is a book I've always wanted to write, or conversely, to just gnaw at those horrible places that we can't live with and make it livable because. And I'm really not that much interested in anything else, although, in fact, I do love to read kind of country English novel. I love Trollope, for instance, so I'm contradicting myself completely. But I think today I couldn't write that kind of book, and maybe I'd be jealous of people that could. But I want to expose those weird, horrible things and hope that people out there are seeing it, and then, you know, and maybe we can, you know, because I find the world so bizarre nowadays and so... people so incomprehensible. I guess I'm trying to reach people whose minds work like I do, and then if I have a reader, I know, hey, you know, I'm connecting to somebody about this stuff, which is for me the important stuff. And in a way, for me, I think my characters are most real when they're thinking, because there's something a little absurd to me about action. I mean, I love it when I was in action, and when I was in the Gulf, it was fabulous, and we all wore camouflage, and yet I knew we were kind of playing at being reporters and playing at being war reporters, because it wasn't exactly a war for us. But in some way, all public political life seems to me just a comedy and not the real stuff. So if I'm at a party discussing, say, having a very serious literature discussion, the way my mind works is, you know, what's going on underneath that? Am I attracted to this person? Are they attracted to me? Or Are they jealous of X or Y? And I'm much more interested in the subtext, you know, rather than the text. And I'm trying to write the subtext, almost like Ivy Compton Burnett writes that subtext there.
Now, I think it's in Horse Feathers that Groucho Marx sings a song called Whatever It Is, I'm Against It.
And <I'm>, yes.
And I wanted to ask, because it seems to me that one of those setups is that you begin in opposition. You begin in opposition or in an adversarial relationship. And is this an obligatory relationship?
I think it's obligatory for me, maybe not for most people in the universe. When I find myself assenting, I feel I don't exist, and I feel like I'm a blob. So I've noticed in groups, very often, say, in a political discussion, since I could take either, I'll just take the other side of whatever's there, and I do feel, you know, that the dialectic is somewhere, the truth is bouncing between the extremes. So, in fact, that is a way to make it emerge. But also there's more energy in opposition. And I'm interested in the energy and the juice, because energy is another, what I see as a problem, is creating energy in life. And Ascent puts us to sleep. And I guess I'm very afraid of falling asleep. And probably I'm a totally normal person with the most banal views. And I sometimes think I've just created this other thing as a way to pretend to be interesting when I'm really just totally normal and middle of the road.
Now, even within the women's movement, in a sense, Some Do is a novel of the women's movement and college. And it begins to veer toward an edge and takes a radical position. Then once you're established as a woman's writer, a woman's movement writer, that was your first book, you begin to launch books that most women, in turn, objected to. In the gay writing movement, much of the sadomasochism of your work in particular has gotten a rather wide berth from certain writers who still want to be talking about unity and collectivity. And I'm wondering, does one finally find oneself in a corner with nothing any longer to oppose, so that one begins to, pardon the dog metaphor here, discover that all along one has been chasing to bite one's own tail?
I think there's always something to oppose, although maybe not in a particular arena. I mean, in fact, there are certain elements that did embrace. You know, I really don't like to say that my last book or two is about sadomasochism, because I don't think, you know, that's just a metaphor. But and actually, that's where kind of certainly the gay movement has gone to extremes. So, you know, and that's okay, actually, when I do get embraced. I felt the feminist embrace of Some Do, and of course I never got reviewed by Ms. again, was a little false, because at the end, everybody's back to doing what they did before all the movements came along. So, in fact, I thought it was a comedy of manner showing how utterly insignificant politics was, and I think Mark Rudd ended up working for his father in a cleaning establishment. And one reason I never was wholehearted, I mean, I marched in the 60s, but I always felt it was silly, because I always felt people have the same desires and whatever. So I never quite believe most revolutionaries.
Because the impressive thing about the stories in Bad Sex is Good by my guest, Jane DeLynn, published, what is the publisher?
Painted Leaf Press.
Is that if one were to take an arc, it seems that at points when most writers formed adaptative coalitions with one form of society or another, yours was always the movement to remain aloof and adversarial. So where most people have either bought a house and settled into it, real estate through the possibility of material happiness as far away from Jane DeLynn as it could be landing. And similarly, the books have allowed one to see a writer proceed in opposition at a time when compromise has been more and more and more and more the desired thing, both in life and in literature. So there's something oddly noble and at the same time upsetting to see a writer who's remained in such an isolationist stance.
Well, there's an embrace of transgressiveness in certain areas. It doesn't seem to include me. I mean, but a lot of the transgressive people are very lauded and receive gigantic grants, so it's hard to see them as transgressive. Well, sometimes I would like those things that you mentioned, but some there's something about my energy that what I want, it recedes from me. And I think this is somehow crucial to my writing, to my life. I guess I need to feel that when people start assenting to everything, when people get, say, their followers, you know, and they become almost a guru to their followers, I've always found that very repugnant because I find it very difficult to honor other people. And although it's pleasant when people come up and do that, I also feel it sort of sucks something away from me, my power, and you want to keep them with you, and then you start to subtly alter perhaps what you say. And I guess I'm afraid that I'd be so susceptible to any kind of praise that I have to, you know, keep it in arm's distance. Otherwise, I would abandon whatever shreds of integrity I have. So it's really my weakness that keeps me in that position.
Your weakness for praise?
My weakness for praise. My desire to be loved makes me very scared of it on any level.
Your desire to be loved as a novelist?
Yes. Worshipped as a novelist.
Worshipped as a novelist, loved as a human being. You must send them all away.
But I'm willing to try something new, Michael, so.
I've been talking to Jane DeLynn, whose most recent book is her collection, Bad Sex is Good, Fiction and Essays. Thank you very much for joining me.
Pleasure to be here, as always.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Special production assistance today from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183. Make you laugh and say, book, tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends and pros and rhymes. Now with a book.